you, sir?
Oh, yeah, I'm looking for a good mystery on something off the beaten track like the Maltese Falcon.
Well, that was a fascinating story. But here's one that has everything the Falcon had and more. It's Raymond Chandler's latest bestseller, The Big Sleep. And what a picture that'll make.
You mind if I look at it? Sometimes I wonder what strange fate brought me out of the storm to that house that stood alone in the shadows. As I probed into its mysteries, every clue told me a different story. But each had the same ending, murder. Every instinct warned me to beware that something more dangerous, more deadly than I'd ever known before was in that room. And suddenly,
I like that. More. That's even better.
Welcome back to the Film and Water Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I am, of course, your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this week to talk about 1946's The Big Sleep, a classic, is our pal, new to the show, the Dr. G, man of nerdology from the Pulp to Pixel Podcast. Dr. G, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me on. I'm pretty jazzed to talk about Bogart and especially The Big Sleep.
Yeah, this is a terrific movie. Now, before we get started, I do have to ask you, as a doctor of nerdology, can you prescribe medicine, or you're not allowed to do that? I get those confused.
No, unable. I just play a doctor on the internet, which Okay. Every time I tell that joke, I feel really bad. I'm like, no, that's a bad thing to do.
It's illegal in some states, I'm sure.
Yeah. So, but no. I am like a golden age character. I've claimed the name doctor, but don't actually have a doctor degree of any sort.
Okay. Good to know. All right. Well, as we said, we're going to be talking about 1946's The Big Sleep, starring Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall, directed by the great Howard Hawks. The plot, so much as it is, basically is Private Detective Philip Marlowe, played by Humphrey Bogart, of course, is summoned to the mansion of a new client by a retired general named Sternwood. This general wants to resolve the gambling debts that his daughter, Carmen Martha Vickers, owes to a bookseller named Arthur Gwynn Geiger. As Marlowe is leaving, General Sternwood's older daughter, Vivian Rutledge, Lauren Bacall, stops him. She suspects her father's true motive for calling in a detective is to find his young friend, Sean Regan, who had mysteriously disappeared a month earlier. Now, so begins a plot so complex, so complicated, that even the author of the book this is based on,
Raymond Chandler,
did not even know how all the murders took place, and it was his own book. That's how complicated this story became. But that is not the point, because this is a movie so delightful, so alive, so fun to watch that it does not matter that, at least for me, halfway through, I had no idea what was going on in the story. Did you have the same issue?
I've been seeing this movie like a number of times since I was in high school, and it's only, I'd say, in the last couple of viewings where I'm like, oh, that's what's happening in the plot. It's serpentine, that plot. That's the best way. But you lose it. You don't really care because
no, right? You don't.
Bogart's magnetism and Bacall's magnetism, and just whenever they're in the scenes together, is just, you're like, who cares about the rest of the plot? I just want to see them have like one-liners at each other, like for a whole movie. It's pretty much the best part about that. But I remember a couple of times I'm like, there's a lot of moving pieces in this plot.
There's at least a dozen characters. I mean, there's like a Nebbish guy played by the great character actor Elisha Cook Jr.
I absolutely love that actor. Like, I always feel – I love him because I feel nothing but sad for him all the time, because he's never – in a good role where things end well for him. Does he buy it in Shane? And, like, I think even in a Star Trek episode. So
that's right. He's just, in that one Star Trek. That's right, yeah. He's always buying it. In every movie he's in, he's always buying it. There's, like I said, there's the younger sister played by Martha Vickers who comes into the film. Her first shot is her wearing scandalously short shorts. Yes. For a 1946 movie, it is pretty amazing that they even got away with that. But as we'll discuss in a scene later on, it's pretty clear that I don't think the censors are paying too close attention to this movie.
Oh yeah, they push the edge on this movie about as far as you can go. And in fact, I just rewatched it last night to get ready for this, and I was really paying attention to that, and I'm like, wow, they really really pushed it. Like they got it past the censors, or they just did it just perfectly to make it work out that it didn't seem too bad, but it's great. Like, there's a lot of beautiful women in this movie and, you know, a lot of great sexy moments too.
Yeah. I mean, there's one part where Philip Mahler refers to Martha Vickers' character as trying to sit in his lap while he was standing up. And this movie is filled with that stuff. I mean, just these incredible bon mons back and forth that is just unbelievable. And, you know, it's Howard Hawks. I think I've quoted this before in a previous episode, but Howard Hawks apparently was famous for saying, a good movie has three good scenes and no bad scenes. To me, this movie has no bad scenes. There's not one scene of this that I don't like. I mean, it's Bogart's almost in every scene, but it moves so effortlessly and so smoothly that you just are so carried away by it that even as you're being handed from character to character, and in a lot of ways, so is Marlowe. I mean, he's following this mystery. Because then it turns out that the bookstore owner, who was the Geiger, has compromising pictures of Martha Vickers' character. And so you kind of find that she's a bit of a weird girl. She's got a lot of problems. Apparently in the original screenplay, based on the book, of course, it was that they were nude photos. And they couldn't get away with that in the movie, so they sort of referencing. And apparently, there's a reference to her character sitting in a Chinese chair, and that is a reference that I had to look up. And apparently, a Chinese chair is a chair built to have sex in. It's a sex chair.
I thought that might be where this is going. I was like, yeah, okay. There's a lot, you know, left on the sort of the cutting room floor because of the censors of the time, but they get away with a lot. But yeah, no, there's plot on top of plot because there's then the Joe Brody character who he knew Geiger but was also kind of competing with Geiger, and so there's a lot of like grifters circling around the outskirts of this story that are kind of drawing everybody into it, into these different blackmail plots. And then, but you know, at the center of it is this constant question of what happened to Sean Regan, the drinking buddy of General Sternwood, or proxy drinking buddy, at least.
Yeah, that's a whole weird angle, because Sean Regan, as they establish, is a much younger man. And yet General Sternwood is this old guy, and you're kind of like, what's that relationship about? You know, and that seems like that they're hinting at something that they can't quite get at.
Yeah. Well, I think with Sternwood, though, is – and you really see it in that first scene is, you know, he is definitely this man who's like – you know, he's a former general. They refer to him as general. So it's – you know, this was a man of action at one point who's now this sort of shell of a man who's, you know, in a wheelchair and – how does he put it? I have so little blood in me that all I can do is sustain myself on heat, like a young spider, like a newborn spider. Yeah, he has, I think, some of like my favorite lines at the very beginning of the movie, where he does things like he says he keeps orchids because it's an excuse for having a hothouse out in the backyard or on the house, the premises, and greenhouse, I should say, on the premises. And he says, but you know, he hates them because their flesh reminds him of the flesh of men, you know, like, what do you say, sweet with corruption. And I was like, this is some pretty beautiful purple prose right there on that one. But it was, I love it every time I hear him give those lines.
Yeah, the screenplay is written by, of all people, William Faulkner, which is and Lee Brackett, who most nerds of us know from being on the screenplay to Empire Strikes Back.
Yes, yes. Although I would have to definitely, for for all the nerds out there who love her, I would have to recommend her Eric John Stark novels. They're great, like, planetary romances of the sort of John Carter vein.
That's really cool. Yeah, I've never read any of those. That sounds terrific.
Yeah, no, they're good. They're good. They're very fun. You can see a little bit of, I think, sometimes hints of, like, some of the Star Wars characters that would come later in there. Just small hints, but they're there.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I do – well, actually, the main thing I love about this, aside from the interplay between Bogart and Lauren Bacall, who, of course, you know, they had wonderful interplay because they were a real-life couple. But Bogart just effortlessly owns this movie in every single scene. I mean, pretty much right after he's hired, he goes to look for this Geiger guy who runs a used – not a used, but like a vintage collectible bookstore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he decides – he figures the best way to go in – you know, like, is this a sort of a disguise, and he decides to affect this kind of nerdlinger accent, and he tips his hat up a little dorky, and he puts these glasses on, and he cracks me up with his little nerd little patois that he's got going, and he's real hot, and he asks for an 1889 Ben-Hur. He asks for a book that does not exist. And Bogart's not known for his comedy, although he did do some comedies, and he's great in them. We're no angels. But, man, he is hilarious in that scene.
Oh, and I love the range because I love the sort of the archetypical Bogart, quick-witted, tough guy, and pretty much his Philip Marlowe or his Sam Spade sort of character. Those are my kind of archetypical versions of it in my head, but I love that moment because I'm like, oh, this is the range of him as an actor, that he's like, he does that and he sells it. You know, I could see him doing a movie as this sort of like nebbish academic the whole time while there's a much more tougher guy in the room. But, you know, but then on a switch, it's right back to that, you know, sort of the tough, smart, capable Phil Marlowe in just a second. I like it when he just tips his hand, his glasses up and down to show her again when he goes back later.
Yeah. And right after that scene where he sort of angers the woman who works at the bookstore because she thinks he's a fake, he goes across the street to another bookstore, and that's where he meets Dorothy Malone, who plays the unnamed Acme bookshop proprietress. And apparently this scene, Dorothy Malone played the scene with Bogart. She had such chemistry with him and was so sort of sexually suggestive that they enlarged the scene to give her more to do because they just thought she was so dynamite with Bogart.
Yeah, no, that's one of my favorite scenes in the movie for a movie that I'm probably going to say that a lot, but that's just another one of those ones where it's just, he's just so smooth. I just love this moment. He's like, I have a bottle of rye in my pocket. She's like, I have some glasses. And there it is. She's closing up the shop. And I'm just like, oh, Bogart. or at least in this case, Philip Marlowe. So smooth. So smooth.
And she takes her
away. Oh, yeah. Go on.
Oh, no. Go ahead.
Yeah, he's very James Bond in that moment, I felt.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, she takes her glasses off and shakes her hair down. And he's like, well, you know. He's all like, yeah. Bogart, they give every woman in this movie is attracted to him. Yes. There's a point where he takes a cab, and first of all, it's a woman cab driver, which is a sort of accidental reference to the fact that this movie was actually shot in 1944 and not shown until 1946 because they were going to hold it off because they wanted to move up another Bacall film that had a more World War II centric plot called Confidential Agent, and apparently that was a giant bomb, and so they then hustled this movie out because they wanted to sort of restore her reputation a little bit. But anyway, the woman is a woman cab driver, and she drives Bogart around, and at the end she says, hey, if you need any other, you know, you need another ride, and she gives Bogart her card, and he says something to the effect of, can I call you again? And she says, I work during the day. Nights are better. It's like everyone loves Bogart in this movie.
It is something I noticed as a great through line through it. So once again, in that case, it's like James Bond, you know, James Bond in any movie, it's like all the women love him. You know, one of the things you were mentioning how it was filmed in 44, apparently in some of the scenes, I believe in the DA's office, there's pictures still of FDR on the walls.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, and then, but by 46, it wouldn't have been there anymore. So, so after the, well, I don't know how much more do you want to talk about the plot there. But,
whatever you want to talk about.
So it's, you know, the scenes with Bacall, definitely after he brings, you know, scoops Carmen up and brings her back to the Sternwoods, and they kind of cover up this murder that's occurred. I like his interplays later, because there's a lot of footwork there in the next day. But I like also how the time, like the amount of action that occurs, because by the time he gets to Brody's place, it's just the end of that same day that he's been out, yet so much action happens. I always think it's like, has it been like 2 or 3 days? It's like, nope, one day.
Yeah.
By the end of one day, he's already gotten to Joe Brody and kind of starting to piece together more of the murder. Now, I think one of the funniest things about this movie that I really didn't recognize until real recently is that, like, two of the major characters in the movie that really do a lot of, like, the inciting incidents and moving the plot along are never seen at all in the film. Sean Regan, who we never see.
That's right.
Who's mentioned and haunts the movie continually throughout. And then Owen, the chauffeur for the Sternwoods, who they find dead in the ocean, you never see him, yet he's also integral to the whole Geiger plot and then the unraveling of the Sean Regan plot later. So it's very funny that those characters, they're mentioned many times, but actually never seen on film.
That's right, the entire story. I think it was Owen is the character that gets killed, that is killed, and it was Faulkner and Lee Brackett that said, they couldn't figure out who killed him by the book, and so they call Raymond Chandler, and he's like, I don't know. He had no idea. All the characters, every single scene, even though this movie has, like I said, about a dozen characters, and you keep being introduced to new ones, each one of them has got its own unique – they all bounce off each other incredibly well, and Bogart has to sort of rough his way through. I mean, Bogart gets knocked around a lot in this movie. He gets punched out. He himself sucker punches a guy, which is amazing because he gets a guy to sort of give in, and the guy figures he's safe, and then Bogart literally just punches him right in the jaw and knocks him out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have, like, the two sort of wild heiresses, you know, there's that sort of, like, patrician father, but, like, sort of crippled and shuffled away. Actually, we don't see him again.
No, we see him in that opening scene, right. Yeah, and then he's
it. And that's it, which is a bit of a shame. I always liked the character. I thought he was – I liked his interplay with Bogart at the very beginning. I thought that was a great part. But you know, a lot of characters just kind of like vanish out of this film as especially with Owen the driver, because I don't think, they've ever really fully resolved who actually moved the body or killed him. I think they said it might have been Joe Brody, but they never really say it for sure.
Yeah, no, like I said, I lost the thread of this thing about halfway through. There are a couple of little fun gags thrown in. Like, there's a guy named one of the more main characters is a guy named Eddie Mars, and he has two henchmen, and the henchmen's names are Sidney and Pete, which are tributes to Bogart's co-star Sidney Greenstreet and Pretty Laurie. I love that.
Oh, so that's the one I'd never known. Awesome.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's a great gag. I love the props in this movie. First of all, there's a bust that pops open to show a camera, which is such a great little thing. And then there's this amazing gun cozy that Bogart has in a car that he pops open under the dashboard, and two guns sit in there. I'm like, oh my, that's worthy of like Batman, if Batman used guns. It's such a great prop.
Yeah, no, it was great. It was like, you know, he knows the packing, and it's not just like, you know, it's not like Rockford pulling his gun out of the cookie jar.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, no, I have a gun rack, a hidden secret gun rack under my dash. It's like, okay, yeah, he's a badass.
Yeah, it's an amazing like, it seems almost a little gimmicky. You're talking about, you mentioned James Bond a couple of times. It seems almost a little James Bondy, but it just, it's so delightful that Philip, I keep calling him Bogart, he's Philip Marlowe, but the character seems so inseparable that he would just, of course he'd have that, because he's a hard-bitten gumshoe, as they call him, a Seamus. Throughout the movie, they call him a Seamus, but I mean, it's so preposterous, but yet again, it's just so effortless and charming that, and again, there's these little great little bits, like there's a scene where Martha Vickers is walking out of a room, and there's the guy Joe sitting next to her, and she bangs him with her purse, And it almost looks like like an ad lib, because he looks genuinely shocked when she slaps him, and it doesn't look like something in the script. It felt like Martha Vickers just went and did that.
There's a lot of scenes like that where there's a lot of there had to have been a lot of ad libbing, I feel, between Bogart and Bacall from time to time too, because otherwise their love life has been perfectly written on the screen. I also love how throughout this movie he just throws zinger after zinger, Marlowe throws zinger after zinger on person, everybody all around him. Like, nobody's like immune or against his safe from his criticisms, his little funny criticisms throughout it. And I love it, especially like the tough guys, because he's always riling them up whenever possible. You know, first time he meets Eddie Mars, and he's just like, just straight out practically like, hey, and how about that wife of yours?
Yeah.
You know, and knowing full well what the situation is. And Mars, I love how Mars' response, he's like, you know, he's like, you take chances, Marlowe. He's like, yeah, well, I get paid too. So there it is. You know, and I like that as the character. He's, you know, he's very straightforward. It's like, yeah, he's got this code and a sense of justice, but he's also like, he's a mercenary too.
You know,
in that way, it's like, nope, I'm also a paid detective, and I have interests in my heart, and I have to definitely defend those. But at this point, though, he's kind of solved after the Brody parties. He sort of wrapped things up, and that's when we get that great scene at the nightclub.
Oh God, yeah.
Or between him and Bacall, which I would have to say was, like, for two pretty much entirely fully clothed people, was probably one of the best sex scenes I'd seen in a movie. Just entirely done verbally between the two of them. I love that scene. How about you?
Oh, yeah. That's the scene I'm thinking of when I was wondering whether the censors were asleep. Because, yeah. I mean, he's talking about how far can you go? And she's like, well, it depends who's in the saddle. And then he's comparing, she's sort of referring to him as a horse. And he's like, I bet you're the kind of guy that likes to get out in front and then come up in the rear. And you're like, oh my God. Like, what were they, you know, they must have just, I mean, this movie was edited, as we mentioned, it was shot in 44, released in 46, and they inserted more scenes later on of Bogart and Bacall, because by that point their relationship had really become a big thing and they wanted to play up that part. And I think that's one of the scenes that they added. And you really do wonder if the censors just weren't even paying attention to those extra scenes, because I don't know how anyone could watch that scene and not realize what it is they're talking about.
Yeah, no, it's really, 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 really racy, you know, and I love it. It's just like, I think when I was younger, I saw it far more innocently. And then, like, as I got older, I was like, oh, that's a much better scene, you know, a scene I already loved. It was like much, much better. And it has Bacall in it, who I think I have to do the obligatory shags. She's hot.
Oh, she was stunning. Absolutely stunning. Yeah.
And that's saying that in a movie, you know, chock full of beautiful women, from Dorothy Malone to Martha Vickers to I think, you know, the taxi driver. Mm-hmm. That was another one. There's just kind of who else? There was the Agnes. You know, he's got this whole like orbit of beautiful women and all femme fatales and all trouble. I think the nicest one was Dorothy Malone's character of the
the bookshop lady. Yeah. I mean, apparently with Martha Vickers, she's so overshadowed Bacall in terms of her sort of sultriness that they cut a lot of her scenes out, because they wanted Bacall to be the star of the show. And he said Martha Vickers is really one of those, even though I said earlier that they don't seem like types, you're right, they are types. I feel like they're unique versions of types, if that makes any sense. But Martha Vickers, is, as Carmen Sternwood, is particularly like a really dangerous girl. She's the kind of character that if you ran into in real life, you'd be like, I got to get away from this girl because she's trouble. And it reminds me a little bit of, did you ever see the movie Broken Flowers with Bill Murray?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Yeah. Now, that's a quasi-detective movie, because he's trying to find the mother of his child. And there's a scene in that movie where he goes to find Sharon Stone, and Sharon Stone's, like, nubile young daughter is there.
Yeah.
And she walks into this room. She's never met Bill Murray before. She walks into the room completely nude, and this girl is, like, 17. And Bill Murray just turns on his heel and walks out, because he just knows this is trouble. This girl, oh, yeah. And he does. He says nothing. And to me, it's like that's a later version of a Martha of this Carmen Sternwood character who is so unbelievably sexy, and she knows that she can manipulate people through that. And Bogart is smart enough to just be like, "I'm just staying. I'm not getting involved." You know, even though Vivian's trouble too, but it's Carmen. You just know that she's going to bring you down if you get too close to her.
Oh yeah, and then. You know, ultimately that's, you know, not to spoil it, but plays out later, at least I think through exposition near the end of the film. But yeah, no, she's definitely like a, I think General Sternwood himself, you know, basically described her as, you know, a child who likes to pull the wings off flies.
That's right.
You know, so this is how he described his youngest daughter.
Yeah.
So that's pretty terrible. So, you know, apparently money did not lead to good parenting.
No.
In the Sternwood house.
This have one other thing that I had to mention. I have in my notes because I didn't want to forget it. There is literally a scene where a guy goes, "Why I?" and he gets interrupted, which to me is like right at like. If somebody wants to parody a 40s movie, they have a guy go, "Why I?" And he like, rears up. And there's literally a guy that says that. Because Bogart gets a drop on a guy, and he has that response. I was like, that is – I mean, this is the archetype for all those other parodies later on. Is the guy literally saying that. I thought that was so charming. I was like, oh, there it is. It's actually from a movie.
Yeah, no, it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of good tropes in there. The Elias Cook Jr. scenes though, I was really happy to see because I'm a huge fan also of the Maltese Falcon.
Yeah.
So where he has a very very important role in that one as well, and to see him again though, but is this kind of like similar but fairly different character? You know, not as young as they were playing him out in the other movie, but he has a tough scene to watch. With Canino in his offices, after Marlo gets himself pretty badly beat up by Eddie Mars's guys.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Elijah Cook was born to be beat up. He was just born to be the guy that's get pushed around because he was slight and he always had that kind of slightly worried look and stuff like that. But yeah, he's one of those guys, those character actors that shows up. And you're just sort of happy to see him. You're just like, oh, that guy. Okay, yeah, that's awesome. I love to see him in this movie.
Now. You know, when I was watching it again last night, I realized that he goes to dinner with Vivian and where they have their fairly raunchy conversation, but though also ends with her, you know, kind of like getting mad at him and leaving. And he immediately, he decides to go to Eddie Mars's gambling house, which apparently looked like it was just at a house. Which I had never realized before. He's like, oh, he's just converted a house into this, like, secret gambling parlor. And when he gets there, she's already there, and she's changed, and she's singing in their lounge. I was like, okay, so that date continued.
Yeah. This is also something pretty clearly that this movie was watched at least a few times by the Lebowski brothers. The Coen brothers for the Big Lebowski, because there's so many elements that they borrow. I mean, there's the guy in the wheelchair who hires somebody. There's the sort of in the Big Lebowski, his wife, Bunny, is the one who's in trouble as opposed to the daughter. But I mean, as soon as I saw that opening scene of the guy in the wheelchair, and I was like, oh, this is the Big Lebowski. This is right that opening scene.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, and there's these secondary blackmailers all circling in the background. You know, yeah, no, it's definitely that is. So once again, has that like archetypical hard-boiled / terribly funny spine in the Big Lebowski as well. But I do love scenes where Bacall does sing. You see it when in their first movie together a lot in To Have or Have Not, because she's actually, I believe, like basically a lounge singer in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
But in this one, it was nice to see her sing again because I love when she sings in the movies.
She was an amazingly sultry movie star. Mm-hmm. No doubt about it. You know, it was funny that I read about that. Apparently, when they gave Warner Brothers gave Howard Hawks $50,000 to purchase the rights for this book, Mm-hmm. And I guess they used to do movies differently back then because they literally gave Howard Hawks the money to buy the rights. And apparently Howard Hawks bought the rights for $5,000 and pocketed the rest. They don't make them like that anymore. You know, you wouldn't have anybody allowed to do that. I just love that idea of like, I'll just keep that $45,000 for myself and we'll be fine. Yeah. He apparently was none too keen on Bogart and Lauren Bacall having a relationship because he was apparently fairly sort of protective of Bacall because he sort of found her. And so he wasn't all that thrilled with it. But of course, you know, what was he going to do? It's, you know, it's Humphrey Bogart for Pete's sakes.
You know, who's, yeah, I mean, don't, can't not put him into scenes together.
Yeah. So. Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah. So I think as the movie starts to wrap up at the end, the final showdown, you know, Bogart, as Marlowe throughout this film is, I think, I always like to say is like all that is man, in that he's, you know, a tough guy, smart and everything. But I do love the bit at the end where, you know, he mentions as they're getting ready with the for the final showdown that, you know, his ribs hurt and his hands are shaking that he can't even load his gun because he's been beat up and he's kind of like pretty tense from all of it. And I like that as a sort of like he's been this sort of like consummate tough guy throughout the movie. But he's now at the point where it's like, he can't, you know, he's still going to see this to the end, but he's, you know, taking a real beating for it. He almost made me think of, John McClane a bit at the end. He's,
I can see like that. Sure. Yeah.
You know, sort of like, okay, I've seen it this far, but man, I really hurt. In fact, I think after he gets that beating through the rest of the movie, you can see him like holding his side.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, a lot whenever he's walking around. So I like that touch that, you know, they kind of to show that he's like, yeah, no, he's pretty hurt pretty bad. That is a pretty savage beating he gets.
He, and he has that big bruise on his chin for like the last like 15 minutes of the movie.
Oh yeah. That's when, he gets socked with the, yep, with the guy when he has the metal nuts in his hand from, yeah, the bolts. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, oh, that's a nasty punch. That's a nasty punch. But you know, I think it fits in that. Well, it doesn't have quite all of the film noir elements. There's not a lot of, like, flashback sequences that you'd often find in a lot of sort of, like, true-to-form film noir. It definitely has that sort of, like, tough, you know, but vulnerable hero in the sense that he can, you know, just as easily end up dead at any moment, yeah, as part of the story goes.
Yeah, it's a terrific movie through and through. It's really a delight to watch. It's all these guys at the peak of their powers. It's Bogart, mm-hmm, Bacall, and Howard Hawks, and then this raft of character actors, and just so much, you know, sort of studio professionalism brought to this story. You know, I mean, again, when you've got William Faulkner on your screenplay, for God, yeah, Pete's sakes, you know, I mean, one brilliant author adapting another brilliant author. It's just, it's the amount of effort they put into these things is just sort of startling because it really just anything. The movie feels effortless. It's not that it doesn't feel like it's heavy, but it or meaningful, but it just breezes by, and it's never anything but a delight to watch.
Yeah, and I think part of my favorite parts is the dialogue because it really kind of just the rhythm of the dialogue in the movie just kind of carries you through some of the more confusing parts of the plot. Where you're just like, I don't care. It's yeah. I just want to hear the next sort of amazingly witty thing that Bogart's going to say to another character, or Bacall will say back to him, or back and forth throughout it. Although it's funny, the scene with him and Eddie Mars in the casino when he goes, I always think it's very funny because every time I watch that scene, I'd swear they are like the best of friends. And that because, you know, they're definitely putting up the, oh, no hard feelings front. But, you know, there should be that they are enemies. So, you know, there should be this like undercurrent of it. But I think they just play, you know, the front of friends so well. It's like, no, that was like a moment where it seemed like they were really good friends. Every time I watch it, I'm always a little confused. I'm like, are they friends now? That almost seems that they are the way they're talking. I'm pretty sure he's the bad guy. I don't think they should be friends now. So
you can't help but like Bogart, you know?
Oh, yeah.
You just can't. I mean, he really is still the quintessential movie star. And you just even when he's someone who's in, you know, maybe he's going to put you in jail, you can't help but like the guy. He just seems like a straightforward dude. So yeah, the Big Sleep is terrific. It's a wonderful film. And I'm really glad I got the opportunity to watch it over again because it was just so much fun. So thank you very much for recommending that we talk about this one.
Oh, of course, of course. like I said, anytime you want to talk about Humphrey Bogart films, I'm a huge fan, so I always like to watch his work and discuss it later. So love his stuff, especially a lot of his stuff with Howard Hawks. Many of the movies he did, they're some of my favorites of his repertoire.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, again, Dr. G, thank you for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you. Thank you.
Where can people find you on the internets?
All right. So I am the host of the Pulp to Pixel podcast, where we are currently running two shows, Secret Sagas of the Multiverse, which is our general discussion geek topic show, and our not as widely produced as at this point, but Welcome to Astro CD, our indexing show, where we're going issue by issue through Kurt Busiek's Astro City series. You can also find us on iTunes and Stitcher, and we have our main website at pulptopixel.blogspot.com. We also have a Facebook page, the Pulp to Pixel Podcasts, and you can find me on Twitter at Pulp2Pixel if you want to give me a shout out.
So, all right. Terrific.
That's about everywhere.
All right. As always for us, if you want to contact the show, you can just use the contact page over on the website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com, or email us at firewaterpodcast@comcast.net. And please follow the show on Twitter, which is @filmandwaterpod. So everybody, thanks so much for listening. Go out and rent The Big Sleep. It's terrific. Absolutely cannot go wrong with Humphrey Bogart, pretty much. So again, Dr. G, thanks for doing the show. And until next week, everybody, that's a wrap.
Tell me, what do you usually do when you're not working?
Play the horses, fool around.
No women?
Oh, I'm generally working on something most of the time.
Could that be stretched to include me?
Well, I like you. I told you that before.
I liked hearing you say it. But you didn't do much about it.
Well, neither did you.
Well, speaking of horses, I like to play them myself. But I like to see them work out a little first. See if they're front runners or come from behind. Find out what their whole card is. What makes them run.
Find out mine?
I think so.
Go ahead.
I'd say you don't like to be rated. You like to get out in front. Open up a lead, take a little breather in the back stretch, and then come home free.
You don't like to be rated yourself.
I haven't met anyone yet that could do it. Any suggestions?
Well, I can't tell till I've seen you over a distance of ground. Got a touch of class, but I don't know how far you can go.
A lot depends on who's in the saddle. Go ahead, Marlo. I like the way you work. In case you don't know it, you're doing all right.